We're going to be joined in a moment by Reiko, whom I've invited to join this Q&A. But I think I'll kick off with a question that I suppose both of you might respond to. I'm just struck over today and yesterday's sessions by the recourse that I don't know whether it's necessarily artists having recourse to it, although in some cases it specifically is, or whether it's also art historians who are complicit in this, to agricultural metaphors and to agriculture as a kind of, as if you like, the sort of reference point of a certain cultivation, put more loosely. This ties us back very obviously to the last program weekend in which James Scott, a very esteemed historian of agriculture, among other things, was presenting his central argument to do with peoples of precisely the non-agricultural world, or at least from a kind of agriculture that one associates with the non-state societies that are, in his case, sort of cling to the upland regions of Southeast Asia. But I think we could speak a bit more loosely about geographies of withdrawal in a slightly wider context. So this is something that came up in... Well, it came to mind, sorry. In fact, in Reiko's presentation as well, there was the phrase, if I'm not mistaken, almost a kind of rallying cry that we must plough the people's everyday life with the persistence of farmers. A rallying cry amongst experimental artists. We must sow the seeds of modern art, weed, fertilize. This is the artist's responsibility to society, I think is what he says. This is it's actually reproduced in the booklet somewhere, I believe, in the Misfits booklet. There was also some sort of agricultural referencing going on in some of the artworks that Sol has presented. So I just thought I would ask very loosely if either of you would like to speak about that, and particularly with Scott in mind, or at least that idea in mind, in the frame of the artist's relationship to the nation and to nation states, because it occurs to me that in these recourses to agricultural metaphors that I've cited, that kind of agriculture is precisely the sort of agriculture that James Scott would associate with bad statehood, actually. And in fact, Reiko as well, I invite all of you to maybe comment on, is agriculture maybe an unfortunate metaphor in some respects, or is it a knowing sort of engagement with that idea, or on the part of the artists, or otherwise?
Could you repeat what you mean by agriculture as a metaphor? Because I think I missed that part.
Okay, so the idea of the artist as having, as part of the artist's calling or practice being compared to agriculture. Oh. I find this really interesting, particularly because in the Southeast Asian context where I'm working, agriculture is a kind of historical, mythological, political text of immense density and depth, and it's one that has been very effectively abused by bad states and continues to be abused in that way. And there's a lot of artists in the Thai context that I'm most familiar with who have sort of bought into an agricultural symbology of power and really have been chewed up and spat out by that state machine, which has co-opted those symbols very effectively. And this is a number of particular examples that I've written about. So I'm wondering whether the fact that agriculture has come up in different ways in all of your presentations, whether there's anything to be made from that, and whether whether there's a key somehow to how states and artists interact.
Can I start with that? The you picked up the farmer's persistence quote from the play, and then play's members, practically they're all urbanite, urban people. And then in this case, the agriculture is a pure fantasy or metaphor. You know, the kind of almost common idea, images of farmer day in, day out, working on the soil. And then I think that's the kind of the projection of city people's agriculture. And then that's certainly a kind of image of farmers nurtured by modern state. Also going back to the Edo period, feudal period, because they put the farmers below samurai, but above all the other class of occupations. So the that's one thing. Agriculture actually in Niigata has a particular resonance because that's the rice country. That they made the best rice in Japan, actually, this is true. And then Maeyama, one of the primary member, he did not go to Tokyo. There's a, you know, always, you know, like people in the countryside or, you know, outside Tokyo to move to Tokyo and then being an artist doing some menial job to make do with their living. He didn't go to Tokyo because he was the eldest son of a farmer family. So they had a land, so that's his responsibility. So he literally could not go, and he still farms today. And then that's a, you know, another way of the disagriculture. And then the disagriculture is not sustainable agriculture, not sustainable in that the, you cannot make living by just farming. And then that's the legacy of the post-war democratization of farming and land reform. So the, he lived that reality. So in his case, maybe it's a bad state, but the he's living with the reality of agriculture.
Thank you. This is a really important question, actually, for how I try to frame this paper. Precisely because, so I try to actually distance the work of Yatou from any kind of reference to agriculture in terms of its cultivation of land or the figure of farmer, precisely because I detected Yatou's investment in elementals of nature versus the agriculture as a culture, human culture, because in my book project, Minjung Art Project, agriculture could, I guess, vastly kind of mean two different things. One is it's manifested in the figure of farmer as a worker that is also differentiated from factory worker in the urban space, but still a figure of labor that can kind of dispel the ills of urban space dictated by the I guess the rules of developmentalism, but also when you utter the term agriculture or kind of this idea of agriculture of space. It's also space of common life, which might have a primordial kind of root in common lifestyle that continues in the modern time. So some other small art collectives of the Minjung art movement, for example, called Turong, would actually utilize the type of common lifestyle. And they turong actually means the little bump that divides land from the farm land and also the roads. So it's kind of like a middle ground, or let's say pathway, as much as like boundary between the land to farm and land to stand on, or I guess your neighbors also land. So it's really complex concept and politicized concept. Mm. Anthropologist Nancy Abelman did an ethnographic work in Gochang in Jeolla province in the late 80s, and she actually studied how farmers' social movements, farmers' movement differed from the city-based student activists' social movement. And they had different kind of ideologies, and there were conflicts. So it's, but I try to kind of, just to repeat, distance Yatu from these other practices that were going on that were more related to, yeah, the concept, yeah.
Can I just refresh the question a bit, specifically for the context of Myanmar, another rice-based society? When I was working on putting the exhibition together, I was struck by the fact that Aung So clearly had a very well-developed sense of responsibility to a people, and that that people was very often characterized as a national we, or a national people, a national community, in his writings. And so this was, in a sense, a kind of contradiction for me as a naive outsider looking at his work, because I'd started from the premise that one of the interesting things that linked these artists was their interest in a kind of larger international, not necessarily internationalist, but certainly international political scenario of the Cold War, and that in each case they had articulated and had in fact internalized quite a transnational mix of aesthetics and ideas and sometimes vocabularies, certainly visual vocabularies. So one thing I had to work through as a curator was, well, actually, I'm wrong to assume that that implies some kind of internationalist outlook. All three of them have a very express concern for their national publics and for national people. So I guess that's more the context that I asked the question.
I think also, he did write to say that the two are not contradictory. To be international, you need to know where you're coming from first. And he justifies his attachment to Myanmar with that. You must know where you are anchored, and then you can reach out to an international audience. And I think, David, you have also seen, maybe some of you have as well, there are many representations of not just farmers, laborers, basically members of the working class in his illustrations, especially the 1960s and 70s. I think definitely representations as such, you don't risk censorship issues. But I think in the case of Aung So, he had a genuine sympathy for the masses as well. Sometimes it could be exoticized. He could have these ideas about a very tranquil lifestyle in the villages. He's an urban dweller. He can't farm. He can't do labor work. He's born with a silver spoon in his mouth. So it's very much like looking at the other side and delighting in it, you could say, I think. Yeah, and it fell in line with the socialist agenda, so that was good, I guess. I don't know if that answers your question.
It's a sympathy with the state, actually. I want to just pause to invite Reiko to pose any questions that she might have for the two presenters. One of the reasons I've asked you to join us here is that your recent book, also available for purchase at the door, sold out. Even better. Oh, sorry. Okay, available for purchase on Amazon.com. Deals in, you know, very explicit and thorough ways with artistic withdrawals of one kind or another, and so in a sense you're unwillingly complicit in the whole framing of this. Of this conversation. So I thought I'd invite you to respond.
Thank you, David. As I listen to, I know Saul's Yatu project a little bit from before. So the but I was very pleased that it's more very nuanced and detailed. I really liked it. And then your Ansu paper, and then like I know I can see lots of resonances. And then like so the first thing I can say is Matsuzawa would have loved Ansu. He would have loved to be friendly with him. Yeah, because they are kindred spirit. But interesting thing, and then this is the what comparative studies really help us understand what are the differences. Because I say Matsuzawa and then Ansu, the kindred spirits, but they live in a completely different society, different environment. And then now I can see Matsuzawa's wilderness is far more urban or far more, modernized, I think, than the Myanmar's wilderness. Or I don't think he was really in the wilderness, actually, but the Matsuzawa could capitalize on the mainstream being well-developed. And then so he can afford to be in the wilderness, and then above all, being very single-minded about his pursuit of immateriality, because he know immediately after the seeing the Tokyo's bombed ruins and firebomb ruins, and he knew he wanted to pursue invisible, immaterial, universal, and then that's something he set his mind, and he remarkably he did it. And then in what I thought interesting as a neither or observation of Ansu is that the what you said, the genuine sympathy for working people is another, and then here comes in very strong element, I think, but he seems to be in society. He never really withdrew in that sense, like Matsuzawa did. And then he touched everything, as you said, acting to illustration, to art making, to the all sorts of things. And then so he found space there, doing anything he could do. And then that's the difference, even though they are both deeply spiritual, deeply meditative, and then both are so voraciously curious people, right? I see lots of not only Buddhism but the science and then philosophy and all sorts of references in Ansu's works. But he could actually, whether on the one hand, Matsuzawa has a tendency to just try to create some single idea with all these out of his curiosity. The Ansu was much more freeform, actually, to me. And then that creates the neither nor situation. And then I think that's, I don't know how he lived, but Matsuzawa was happy being single-minded. But I think Ansu was probably happy not single-minded. So I tend to be a biographer, so I read this way. So if you can tell me a little more about him, I would very much appreciate. And then Yatu's case is also another interesting case, because I noticed that riverbed, dry riverbed, is primarily sandy. That's another different thing. Because usually in Japan, dry riverbed is either stony or grassy. And then so when I first saw the picture, and then there's another resonance, Sekine's the phase Mother Earth, from 68, and then they are doing, although there are lots of Korean artists knew a whole lot about international art scenes, especially via Japanese art journalism, right? So probably they know all about everything, and then they knowingly do what they are doing. So The Yatou's case, however, is that you gave the more political reading today. And then as of kind of in relation to Minjung art and then Tansefor, and then is that something, it seems they had the very strong political orientation themselves, right? That's coming from what they did rather than you are rereading it. So I'm just curious about that part.
In terms of the biography of Aung So, I actually don't really know from where to start. on the basis of the shared interest in spiritual practices, he was not strictly the spiritual ascetic either, because he drank a lot. And he drank a lot too. Okay, so I think he had his own personal approach to practicing Buddhist tenets, and I think he did very much everything in his own way, the way he dressed, so on and so forth. So it's kind of difficult to pin him down to a specific character. Like, I was told that, you know, maybe one day he would be dressed in, like, sports shirt and pants. And like, 2 days later, he would be with, like, you know, unshaved and dressed like a Himalayan hermit or something like that. Yeah. Mm. I'm not too sure. Is there any specific aspect of his life that might be of particular interest? I just don't know where to start.
So, in case of Buddhism, he had the Matsuzawa had the middle school friend who became the top priest of esoteric Buddhism sect, and then so he became that the priest friend was very. Very useful sources for his very in-depth knowledge. Like I check, you know, each phrase of what the Buddhist terminology he uses, and then like, you know, oh boy, he's looking at the, like some Buddhist theology, you know, like academic article or something. Mm-hmm. So and then also he was mindful about how non-Zen Buddhism was practiced in. Popular, you know, among regular people. So he was actually interested in new age type of new Buddhism too. Mm-hmm. So like he, as I said, he's very voracious with the in terms of searching for knowledge. Mm-hmm. So if, you know.
I think in terms of curiosity, yes. But also from what I know at least, he didn't have the chance of having a guru in Myanmar. None of his friends and his family members I spoke to said that he ever went to a temple to see a monk or even so-called a Zolji, a sorcerer locally. So it would seem that he had a very eclectic approach and he just picked up things wherever he went. So the esoteric sources, for example, he could have picked up from books. Some of these things you find it in daily life as well. We call them esoteric references, but they're actually integrated into daily life. You have these auspicious talismans that you find in shops, so on, and like in Thailand as well. And then in terms of Zen, he would have read up. But honestly, we don't have books on Zen. We don't have books on Tantra. Nothing that came down to us. So it is still a mystery how and where he learned. A lot of it, in some of his writings, he recounted experiences of meditation in which he encountered higher spiritual beings. Whether we want to believe or not, that is another matter. But he also said that he actually stayed with yogis in the Himalayan region, and no dates. We suspect that it is likely to have been after he left Shantiniketan sometime in 1952. But then the next question is, how does someone remember something so clearly that he learned more than 30 years ago? Because in the 80s he was talking about these things. But between 1952 and like the 1980s, he never went back to India. So it's still pretty much a mystery where his sources were.
Yeah, so I guess I might be at fault to politicize Yatu. I had a great moment of going through the later catalogs of Yatu from the 2000s and saw basically a reference to Liu Fan by one art historian and reference to Minjung art by another art critic. So I thought, wow, this is so fascinating. How can two supposedly diametrically opposite camps meet in one bookcase, right, of an office of this nature art biennial. So I started kind of looking at how the processes of the ultimate goal of national metaphor could operate in very different ways. So one is, you know, Minjung nativism, right? The other might be the Taoism of nature-oriented Korean people per se, or all these other multivalent metaphors that go with it. But I realized that writing this paper and researching a little farther, Yatu essentially was kind of a product of this region, Daejeon and Gongju region, where very active performance artist and conceptual artist, Lee Geun-yong, also kind of had influence, as Hyunjin is very well aware of. Kind of tracing Yatu alongside the performance artworks that were made in the 60s and 70s, I also realized that, oh, these performance artworks were very much urban-centered compared to Yatu. So that's one way of looking at the 60s and 70s differently. And compared to Yatu, Minjung art's understanding of reality and Hyunjang, the site, was also very much human-centered. So that's another way of kind of having Yatu as this, I don't even want to say the critical lens, but like it's something that can...
A circuit breaker.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Push the big stones, the rocks of Korean art history, a little bit to a different direction. Mm.
We have very limited time, but I wanted to give the audience a chance, if there are any burning questions, to pose them.
Thank you, everyone. I have some kind of memoir of mine about the Yatu. Actually, would be helpful to kind of rethink sort of what David actually mentioned about. I mean, I guess you mentioned in terms of the context of the last session we did, actually, the Flight from Empire with James Scott. Sort of the Yatu's position in a way, quite interestingly, they're the escaper from this kind of national hegemony argument of postmodernism, actually in the 90s. Because the two member, I was a student of these two member when I was 15. And at the time it was 1991, they actually, Hong Myung-sup, he's the artist, but actually was really articulated theories of the postmodernism, and he published two books at the time already. But they actually quite well informed about this kind of Western modernism, like postmodernisms, but they never used this tool to part of this kind of national hegemonic, you know, power games. Was ongoing between Minjung Group and Dansaekhwa. And sort of the way the Daejeon is also, they're both, reside in the Gongju and Daejeon is mostly later on Daejeon, and then some went to the Seoul to teach, become a professor. But the Gongju, Daejeon is sort of the city, it's one of the big city, but without memory. Because it was built after Korean War, so the city was purely urban and has no memories. But Gongju is once the capital of the Baekje dynasty. So, and somehow their for me, like uncompromising attitude is sort of important to not willing wield by any kind of hegemonic power games, you know. So in terms of that, I think the sort of like they made them decentralized constantly. Sort of they later on, they, even though they become part of the professor of the Seoul art school, but they never part of this game actually. So this sort of this attitude always involved, and somehow they had their own Biennale, small Biennale, nature Biennale in Geumgang area, Gongju, but it was the way they actually bring the sort of the world to the small center, their own center, but not. They never compete with the big biennales or whatever. So these contexts would be interesting to think metaphorically, you know, how these artist community, they sort of located as a kind of constantly decentralizations and sort of anti-state history building power games. Yeah.
Thanks, Hyunjin. I'm sorry to close the session, but I'll have to. Thank you all very much. We have, following this session, film screening. Those of you who saw last night's screening, I imagine, will be keen to see more. The program is called Pilipinas, or What Do You Think of the Philippines, Mr. Ionesco? It's a series of a selection of works made by Rox Lee's many collaborators and friends in same milieu in Manila. And for those of you with the stamina to last through the whole evening, there will be some refreshments served afterwards. I invite you to hang around and join us to enjoy that. Thank you very much to all of our presenters, and see you soon.